switch it up a little bit further and talk about college students and alcohol use. So let me just ask you, well, it's ready now, but who are you? Are you all college administrators, or are you, what do you all do? How are you, why are you here? Who wants to say? Who's a college administrator on a college campus? Public health, or?
Student nurse.
Okay, oh, student nurse, okay, great. How about you, what do you do?
I work with teens in high schools and middle schools.
In high schools, okay, great. And how about you, what do you do?
Center for Disease Control.
Okay, CDC. Well, I won't ask each of you individually, but you can tell me later. And what I'm talking about today is hiding in plain sight. I was interested in low-risk drinkers in the Greek system. I'm a research psychologist by training. My doctorate is from the University of Virginia. Oh, excuse me, my name is Lydia Kilos. Nice to see you. So I'm Lydia. And I started... You know, I'm a psychologist. I started with the National Social Norms Institute, and as a person who works with the Social Norms Institute, I was asked to attend lots of college health meetings, and lots of college administrators were present. What they said repeatedly was, our problems with alcohol on a college campus are related to our Greeks, and by Greeks I mean members of the fraternity and sorority system. So there was so much finger pointing at the students who were involved in the Greek system that, as a psychologist, I thought, if this were a family systems therapy, somebody is being scapegoated, our Greeks, perhaps with good reason, perhaps not. And what else is happening on this college campus while we're all pointing a finger at the Greek system? So I became interested in looking at people who were involved in fraternities and sororities, and let's just start with that. Oh. Okay, so let me say this. Up front, I had data from three universities. Two are in the Southeast and one in the Midwest. These arrows are not pointing to my university specifically. So, but I should tell you that these are samples of convenience because I had access to this data. So my sample is the data that I used. It's spring 2008 American College Health Assessment data. Have any of you worked with this data? ACHA, okay, so you know a little bit. College health assessment data is really unique in that we ask students a lot of questions. There is a national sample. You can look online and see schools broken down by region, which is very interesting. But they ask lots of questions about sexual behavior, about tobacco use, which we've been talking about alcohol use. And the reason that American College Health Assessment data is so helpful for us at the Social Norms Institute is that they ask the difference between the reality and perception of health risk behaviors. Do you all know much about social norms? Okay, good. You probably knew a lot more than I did when I started 2 years ago at the Norms Institute. In any case, so I have data from three schools. The schools have between 17 and 30,000 students in each of them. I chose those schools because they had a large Greek population. I selected students from the Greek population. I had 276 from these three schools who were fraternity or sorority members. Most of them were female, 61%. And the data, I cleaned the data that I had from the schools. So all my students were 18 to 24 years old. They all had a valid response to sex or gender. And they I cleaned for valid responses to alcohol-related questions. So you had to respond in a way that, you know, you didn't say you drank for 46 hours the last time you partied or socialized, things like that. Okay, so initially I wondered, what was the prevalence rate of low-risk drinking? You know, are there low-risk drinkers in the Greek system? It is with good reason that we question whether or not there are low-risk drinkers in the Greek system. You know, and we see in media and the images around college campuses are partying and socializing, and often students are doing that with their fraternity and sorority letters on. So, what's happening here? I wanted to look first at sorority and fraternity, men and women, women and men. And what I found was this. I evaluated first their drinking risk. Now, in the sorority system, so women are first in the purple, I have some low-risk drinkers and abstainers who are sorority members. I have 30% of my sorority women are low-risk drinkers. I have about 7% who abstain entirely. And again, I have a much larger, as I might expect, a much larger percentage, about 65%, who are high-risk drinkers. Now, how did I come up with these categories? Actually, it turned out to be rather lucky. So by school, by sex, so if you're a female at one of these schools, I looked at the median alcohol use for females by school. And it turned out that for each school, the median level was about 4 drinks per event of partying or socializing, which lines up very nicely with NIAAA standards for high-risk drinking. Well, for men by school, it turned out it was 5 or more drinks, which also, it was about 5.2 or something, a little over 5. But again, lines up very nicely with NIAAA standards. So that was, if you want to say lucky, we'll call that lucky. So in any case, so then for men, the dark blue are my fraternity men. I have about 25% who are low-risk drinkers and about 5% who abstain. And again, a much 70% are considered higher-risk risk drinkers. But that's how we fall, and that was a bit unexpected. So we can see that nearly 33% of Greek members are low-risk drinkers, which led to some further questions. Are these low-risk drinkers and high-risk drinkers similar in their perceptions of peer drinking norms? Do the low-risk drinking Greeks, do these two groups of people, do they use similar protective behavioral strategies when they're consuming alcohol? And what are the prevalence rates of negative consequences? What kinds of negative experiences are they having as a result of alcohol use? So what are some of the similarities and differences between these two groups? So first, because I was looking at social norms, I wanted to know what the gaps are. I mean, as you all know, with social norms, we look at the gap between reality and perception. So when I want to start with this, I wish I had like a little thing, you know, pointer, but in any case, I want to start with this farthest on the chart, these two all students graph. So we have in green the reality of all students. And most students at these three schools had about 4.5 drinks when they partied or socialized. Their perception was that other students had about 5.5 drinks when they partied or socialized. So that's across the three schools. And that maps pretty well onto what we see nationally. There's about a 1 drink difference in terms of reality and perception. But then look at my low-risk drinkers here. When they party or socialize, they're having about 2 drinks. And they think their perception is that most students have about 5 drinks. What's interesting about that to me is that low-risk drinkers are partying in a high-risk environment. 70% of the people around them are drinking at a much higher rate. And yet low-risk drinkers aren't thinking that most students have 7.5 drinks when they party or socialize. Yet the high-risk drinking Greeks, about 70% of their friends, are having 7.5 drinks when they party or socialize. Does that make sense? So this is really interesting to me. Despite the fact that they're partying in a high-risk environment, their perception isn't way off of the reality. And we can see there are some statistically significant differences between my high and low-risk drinkers in terms of how much they consume, their perceived consumption, how much they think others drink, and then the number of times that they binge drink. So over the past 2 weeks, my high-risk drinkers had an episode of binge drinking a median of 3 times, 0 for my low-risk drinkers. So the protective behaviors that some of you might be familiar with that we examine in the American College Health Assessment data are alternating beverages, not exceeding a set number of drinks, choosing not to drink alcohol, using a designated driver, eating before or during drinking, having a friend monitor you, keeping track of your intake, pacing yourself, having 1 drink or fewer per hour, avoiding drinking games, or having an alcohol look-alike. So here are some of the differences between my high-risk and low-risk drinking Greeks. Now, this is interesting to me for 2 reasons. As I might have expected, my low-risk drinkers are significantly more likely to use most of these protective behavior factors. Specifically, they're more likely to alternate an alcoholic beverage with a non-alcoholic beverage. They're more likely to say, before they get ready to go out and party, they might say to themselves, you know, I'm going to not drink tonight. Maybe I have a big organic chemistry test on Monday or whatever. I'm choosing not to drink. They're more likely to track themselves, track the number of drinks they have, to pace themselves to 1 per hour, to avoid drinking games, or to have an alcohol lookalike. But it gets interesting to me right around here. What's happening in these two? I'll tell you. My high-risk drinkers are significantly more likely to engage in these two protective behavior factors, using a designated driver and eating before or during episodes of alcohol use. Now, what's interesting about this to me is that it turns out that low-risk drinkers are engaging in protective behavior factors that keep them drinking at a lower rate. So they're saying ahead of time, I'm choosing not to drink, or they're deciding I'm not going to be involved in a drinking game, or I'm going to alternate my beverages. You know, things like alternating your beverages and setting the number of drinks that you have, or sorry, that's not a good example. Well, alternating the number of drinks that you have, or pacing yourself, these keep you drinking at a low rate. If you're a high-risk drinker, you're using protective behavior factors that keep you drinking at a high rate. So you're just saying to yourself, well, I'm going to get a designated driver, but I'm going to drink as much as I want. Or I'm willing to eat beforehand. Oh, thank you. Time flies, doesn't it? I'm willing to eat beforehand, but I'm going to keep drinking as much as I want. Oops, okay. So that was interesting. Then we had some negative consequences that I wanted to evaluate: physically injuring yourself or another person, being involved in a fight, doing something that you regretted, forgetting where you were or what you did, and unprotected sex or threat of force involved in your sexual activity. Now, again, as I might have expected, my low-risk drinking Greeks are significantly less likely to experience these negative consequences, significantly less likely than the high-risk drinkers. But what I find interesting here is that still 25% of them are saying, you know, I was engaged in some behavior that I regretted as a result of my alcohol use, and I forgot where I was or what I did. You know, further unprotected sex, also 10% is higher than I would like to see. But still, this is just mostly to be expected. I just wanted to show you. So the discussion, we have these high-risk drinkers. This is the highest risk thing I could find someone doing. He has a beer in his hand. He's wearing a helmet, which I appreciate. But here we have low-risk drinkers. They're involved in a very high-risk environment. And what's interesting about this to me is that they neither increase their consumption rate to match the rate of their high-risk drinking friends, nor do they increase their misperception rate, nor do they think, well, everybody's drinking this much because 70% of my friends are drinking this much, despite the fact that they're consuming alcohol in a very high-risk drinking environment. Oops. And I have some resources here. So the reason that, again, that I thought this was really interesting is that this is sort of spinning a little bit of our conversation on an axis. So it's, what are we doing that's positive? What are some of the Greeks doing that's inclusive and empowering? And that's why I thought that was particularly interesting. And feel free, please, if you are interested in emailing me with further questions, that'd be great. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all our speakers. We've got about half an hour for questions, and I'll just open up the floor. If you'd identify. Go ahead, sir.
My first question is, did you happen to look at fraternity and sorority and the Greek or the National Panhellenic Council versus the IFC versus white fraternities versus white fraternities?
That's a great question. Our sample that we had actually is about 82% white. So it's across whoever responded to the National College Health Assessment data is included, but we didn't have enough of a response rate to divide. So National Panel and I don't know the name.
Is the National Panel and Council is Black Fraternity Panel and Council is Black Fraternity?
Okay. People always ask about that. I should say something up front about it, but it was just based on a response rate to the survey. It certainly would be interesting to go further with that research.
Other questions for any of the speakers? Anyone? Yes?
Question for Lori. What was the name of the online tobacco cessation program that you used? I know you said it was unique in the country. We have one that we're using in North Carolina. I'm just wondering if it's the same thing.
This one's called Second Chance, and it's an alternative to suspension program, not a cessation program. So it's hopefully moving you towards cessation, educating them about the tobacco industry and their interaction with tobacco, and helping them make decisions around quitting, thinking about setting quit dates, and then moving them towards again cessation. So Second Chance, and it's on the RMC website. A link to Second Chance is if you go to rmc.org. you go to the tobacco section, you'll see links to all the second chances of information.
Okay. Yes.
That's a great question, and we're still looking at the data. And I'd say that we have to look at the data at the state, not just in the controlled tobacco prevention initiative, and work with the state health department here to look at that across all the state programs. So we're still looking at it, and we're in a quandary here because funding's cut, and a lot of people in those positions are moving elsewhere, but we're still committed.
We would likely not be able to look at just the districts that we funded. We would have to look at the state as a whole or perhaps the region based on the data.
Other questions? Yeah. Yes.
For the last speaker, I guess I've got two questions. One is, like you said, it was kind of counterintuitive to you about the no designated drinker not eating before. Seem intuitive that for low risk drinkers, you're not drinking and you're using alternate lookalikes, that you don't need a designated drinker, you don't need to go out. It seems like everything's like that. I guess the second one was, if I understood, you said it was social norms, as four for females, five for males. Could you, within your survey, the Greek system, so should you update your social norms to your social norms in the Greek system? Assuming that's how you define your misconception, is that part of your social norm?
No. High risk and low risk was not based on the Greek system specifically. It was based on the college campus. So everyone in the college campus. And we don't specifically, the schools that I work with are 9 schools nationwide on developing a social norms campaign. We don't specifically develop campaigns for people who are involved in the Greek system. It's different from the Greek system.
Because your first lesson can be from like 276 to the Greek, then you expand it, I guess, later to everybody.
It was based on the median for your sex at your school, and you're high risk if you drink above that number. So it, but risk for the Greek system wouldn't be different than risk for everyone.
Yeah, it seemed like you were trying to get to, I was understanding the misconception was biggest, or misconception is the same between low risk and high risk.
Misperception? No. Low risk drinkers drink about 2 drinks when they party or socialize, but they think that most students have about 5 drinks when they go out. Most students in reality have about 4.5 drinks when they go out. So low risk drinkers are pretty clear with how much other students are actually drinking.
Okay, so that was I'm sorry. So assume that I've talked to you.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I guess the first question is, do you think it's an explanation could be that if you're low risk, you don't need a designated driving fee?
Well, that's a good question. And I don't think so. Because if you are going out and having 3 drinks, you may still need a designated driver. So I think that planning ahead to have a designated driver is still very wise and a good idea. It's just that these high risk drinkers, and perhaps this has something to do with our social norms campaign, talking about the fact that most students use a designated driver.
Are there any programming that's planned based on this research at those universities?
Well, they already have social norms campaigns in place, but there is programming that is for Greek specific students. So this idea that when you speak to a group of students who are involved in fraternities and sororities, if you make a suggestion that everyone in the room is a high-risk drinker, you really can alienate 33% of your population who are very Greek though. So this kind of information is useful in the programs that are already taking place in terms of changing some of the ways that we speak to fraternity and sorority members about their alcohol use. And if you use something like social norms, you can turn it on its ear. Although it's not a majority, 33%, it's a large minority. You could say Well, I know that 33% of you in the room, you know, are very reasonable, very responsible in terms of your alcohol use. Here's what I know about 70% of you. You tend to use designated drivers, you know, at a high rate, and you tend to choose to eat. So using some of those empowering messages to change the way that we approach.
Is it strictly a seminar conversation with each story or family?
You know, it's different at the schools that we work with, and I don't go to those schools and deliver the messages, so it just depends on how their social norms campaigns work at those schools and how administrators deliver information to those families.
Did you have a question a minute ago?
I have a question for Maya. So you talked about some of the tobacco policies in place at the schools, and you mentioned a couple of things. One, make down on the list was referring to mandatory tobacco programs. Could you talk a little bit about what is out there and what is available?
The mandatory tobacco program, actually, Janet, do you know the name of that? Tap and Pay.
There are a number of different programs that different areas of use, not being one, Pay and Tap being one. Some programs, youth actually cessation programs might end, but a lot of them were also sort of developing their own. So it would be more about, as opposed to just finding or penalizing, were they engaging in some kind of program.
And specific programs, when you mentioned, I think the online one was the race modification program.
So if a school refers someone, there's an actual program for them to go to?
In some schools. My understanding is that school really needs to have the program.
That's where the funding cuts really have probably had the most severe impact.
Yes.
Thank
you.
Quick question for Dr. Ryder. So I think you showed that in the smoke-free or areas where there were smoke-free, there was less tobacco marketing. Is that right? There was more tobacco marketing in areas where
what we found was that in the community that had 100% smoke-free ordinance, there was more tobacco marketing, and we had a different study to talk about that showed that after a community goes smoke-free in Kentucky, we could see a natural decline in the current smoking rate, and part of the assumption is that the increased marketing is to overcome the natural decline that occurs.
Do you have any evidence that there was more smoking adoption as a result of those marketing efforts?
We do not. We do not, because this was cross-section.
I'd like to ask one question to you. So you remember that you did online survey, right? And then I remember that the response rate is about less than 40%, right?
31.9.
Right, so I'm wondering that if you have same opportunities next time, so how do you plan to increase that response rate?
Online is extremely hard, especially with college students, because they are inundated with online surveys. Idea is to increase the number of pre-contacts, telling them that in a few days, maybe if we increased it to 2 instead of 1, or had a larger incentive. That may help for some reason. Sometimes when you offer big incentives that they're in a pool to get. I know we had 40% respond when we did a single school with a large incentive. So
I just created from 5,000.
We had, yes, right? Yes.
How about if you give them $10? So you think that if you increase the amount of the incentive, so
committee sponsored by the community in committee. Well, I don't know if it's this, if it's the single incentive, or is it that you would be in a pool for a much larger incentive, like a $250 gift certificate to America's largest online.
What did you say the gift card is for?
To America's largest online Amazon.com.
Go ahead.
They will, if you get an electronic code that they can redeem to download MP3 files or.
I have a question for Lori and Tessa. I was just wondering when you chose the 15 school districts to work with, how did you base that? How did you prioritize which schools to work with in the state? And then also, with your professional development that you offer, how did you identify what type of professional development that schools need?
That's a great question. Thank you. For the district grants, those were competitive district grants. So we were able to fund 15 districts, and those represented 12 grants. So there was one district that went in as a region. I think the first year we had six additional, so there were 18 grants that came in. And we had very strict criteria for that was included in the RFA that went out all kinds of things. I don't know why I'm getting nervous here at Mary Ann. but there was very strict criteria included in the RFA, and the way we evaluated the applications was we chunked them for the large districts, the medium districts, and the small districts. So they were competing against each other in those categories. A small district that didn't have the grant writers that the large district had was competing against other more small rural districts across the state. We looked at all kinds of things in their application, from background, the data, their intent, what they plan to do, the history of what they were going to do, the capacity of them to do the work. Did they know the population that they were serving? What were the strategies that they were proposing related to those essential components? Did they link up? So we really looked at the essential components and demographics for their region and what they proposed to do. The professional development, we did needs assessments all throughout. So we looked at the application, we looked at their needs, or the needs right up front. Did they even understand what data collection was about? Did they understand what it meant to reach the disparately affected populations in their district? How about policy? Were they just thinking about policy, the written policy, or were they also thinking about what was extremely important, and we provide a lot of professional development on, was the translation of policy to district level practice. So we did needs assessments throughout. We looked at their reports, the mid-year and the final reports, to see what additional needs they had. We asked them. We also looked at the national trends, national data, to see what was coming out, and provided professional development on really the best of the practice, what was happening, what CDC was saying at the national level, to make sure that they were using similar things across districts and really best or promising practices in the country. And they needed a lot of help. Professional development was huge. TA was huge.
Yes, sir.
Christopher Duff over here. In terms of, you found no differences across the two communities at a very high rate of smoking in terms of 40%, right? I wonder if you thought about or considered or looked at sort of a median age of initiation and considered laws that were in place at the time the person initiated cigarette smoking.
We didn't look specifically at that. I can tell you, though, that in Kentucky, we have smoking rate in Kentucky. In the general population, 18 to 24 year olds, it's 34.9%. So, and then you factor in being exposed to nightclubs and bars, or people who go out to nightclubs more likely than smokers, it may have been that we were just capturing that little sample. But no, we did not specifically look at engagement or initiation
Anyone else with questions? Either in the policies or in the marketing, were the new form of tobacco mentioned, or are they too new? This snus or snus? I'm not sure the pronunciation, frankly.
Snus.
I guess. Were they those mentioned in the marketing, or are they too new, or in the policies, if those are too new? Do you know?
I can tell you that snus is it's huge as far as promotional items, what people are exposed to. We did not specifically look at that in this realm, but it's kind of the new fight. Gearing up.
Those weren't mentioned in the policies yet because they're too new, I'm assuming, the new form of tobacco? Right.
We did ask a question about whether you can have other forms of tobacco.
Okay.
I think snus is, it might be something kids are using in schools in some areas and less common
than cigarettes. Okay. Other questions, if we have any more? None. Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Question for media. Do you have data about the risk of having a sticker among students who are not part of the group? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Do you have data about low risk and high risk drinker among students who are not part of the group?
I do compare that. I can tell you just super briefly about it. It turns out if you are a low risk drinker and you're in the group system, you are significantly more likely to experience regret, do something that you regret, and you will be more likely to forget your behavior if you are a low-risk drinker in the grief system versus out of the grief system for those colleges. If you're a high-risk drinker, it's the same. You're not significantly more likely to experience any negative consequences as a result of being in the grief system. So, and there are higher rates of high-risk drinkers in the grief system than outside of the grief system, but there are still significant rates of high-risk drinking outside of the grief system. So the scapegoating is an issue.
Other questions? Not seeing any. I'd like to thank our speakers once again, and I thank all of you for coming this morning. Thank you.